We'll call the meeting to order. And go to roll call. Member Banks?
Here.
Member Markley?
Here.
Member Raymond?
Here.
Stitch?
Here.
Member Suter?
Here.
Member Wax?
Here.
Vice Chair Cohen?
Here.
Chair Olson?
Here.
All right, moving on to item three, public comments. I'll take public comment in the room or in safe parts. Yeah.
Folks, Robert from Quakey's Bay. I got three quick ones. One is I noticed in the agenda, I comment pretty frequently these meetings. The actual public comments aren't referenced in the agenda, it just says public commenters. So I hope staff are keeping track of those, even if they're not there in the agenda specifically. The second actual comment is related to the Sutter hospital development. That was reporting back to the BPAC on that. But I found out as of June, there was a Senate Bill 830 from Jesse Aragon, co-sponsored by Buffy Wicks, about CEQA, a streamlining of that development. It does refer to vehicle miles traveled impacts and greenhouse gas impacts and transportation impacts. But that language is only amended in June and put in place there. It supposedly already has an endorsement of Memoryville City Council. I think this group would really benefit from getting an update from the senator's office on that bill. It's pretty far along in the legislative process right now, unfortunately. I noted to them that there hasn't really been any committee outreach, as far as I know, in Emeryville around that Senate Bill 830. So it's very timely. The legislative agenda is winding up. So go ahead and get on this path if you want to try to provide any input. The second one is about San Pablo Avenue. There have been updates since the last time we met. Alameda CTC has updated the information on their website to indicate no longer a 2026 construction start estimate, but now 2030 at best. And they've also estimated the cost to close to $250 million. So far, they've only fundraised around $15 million of that $250 million for the project. And as of this morning, they actually reallocated that funding over to the East Bay Greenway project because they knew that they weren't going to be able to spend that money in time. So now there's $0 available for that project. City of Oakland has their own project going on in the meantime via paving. City of Berkeley has raised some funding for the Ashby interchange. City of Emeryville has nothing right now for San Pablo Avenue. Oakland, the Bike Pedestrian Committee is hearing from Alameda CTC with updates in November. Again, this is a really important issue and something that's very timely, and I highly suggest that the Emeryville BPAC also request an agenda update from Alameda CTC staff to understand what's going on and what you could do to help push that forward sooner.
Any other public comments? That's it. All right. That we will move on to item four, approval of 5:14, special 15 minutes.
Move to approve.
One second.
Senator Banks?
Aye.
Markley?
Aye.
Raymond?
Aye.
Stitch?
Aye.
Member Suter?
Aye.
Member White?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cohen?
Aye.
Chair Olson?
Aye.
And move on to action items. And item 5.1, like action on confirmation.
All right. So everyone, I am Ryan O'Connell, a senior civil engineer in the Public Works Department, here to present on this item. Presentation. There we go. All right. So I think we hinted at this at a prior BPAC meeting, maybe last year, that we're going to look into doing a pilot project to do a bike detection light. So I'm going to talk about what that is today briefly. So, the light to improve safety and certainty at intersections. And so the challenge is, as you go to an intersection today, a lot of our intersections have video detection. The video detection is set up to pick up bikes from various spots of the intersection. So whether they're in the vehicle lane, in the dedicated bike lane, or, you know, slightly over those edges, we try to detect them. But even with that, there's a lot of uncertainty if you are being detected. And this is, you know, all over the world, really, this problem happens. When you don't know that you're being detected, you do risky behaviors. It leads to frustration. You might run the red. You might get frustrated, get up on the curve ramp, press the button, and cause you some unnecessary delays. So really just leaves you with a poor user experience at the end of the day when this happens to you. So what we're trying to do is, let me go back to this sign. So this is a product from Iteris that we have gotten a quote for. We're looking to purchase this year as part of our standing on-call signal maintenance contract and install it at a project or a pilot intersection. So this is how it comes out of the box. It comes, it's a little sign. It says bicycle detected when illuminated. We're going to sight it at that location that we pick in a very visible spot near the bike lane area. The way it works is as you get detected by the video detection, it will illuminate blue. And pretty simple as that, just bicycle detected when illuminated. So where we're thinking, we have three locations. I want to kind of run them by you and have the BPAC pick tonight which intersection we pilot this at. So what we're looking for is an intersection that makes the biggest impact. We're looking for a high volume of bike intersection, something with significant bike and pedestrian traffic, maybe a complex layout or something weird with the phasing of the intersection, a known area where you've had detection issues there and you feel you've been skipped by that signal. And the three signals that I have for you to pick from today are 40th and Fordham Street, where there are bike lanes in each leg of the intersection. There is split phasing at the intersection. So if you're coming from the south or the north, it's kind of confusing if you're detected, if you're up next, or if you're going to get your green. The other one is 40th and Adeline, also has bike lanes in each direction. There's a bike box on each side on the north-south approaches of Adeline at that intersection, and another one with high volumes of bikes. And then the last one is one on Hollis and 59th Street. So this is one where we have bike boxes in the east-west direction onto our bike boulevard corridors. And there's been issues with skipping there that we've heard from the BPAC, actually, and obviously quick fixes. So that are could be solved by this if you know you can see that you're being detected on your east-west movement. There's no bike lanes on the north-south movement, so we would only do it for two lanes on that intersection. The other intersections, we would try to do it for all four lanes. So I will pause there. Sorry, to pause there for BPAC input moment. And if there's any questions before we get there.
Yep. If anyone has any clarifying questions before we just our comments for this proposal.
What was the third?
59th and Hollis.
Okay.
Repeat all of them?
Yeah. So 40th and Fordham Street, 40th and Adeline Street, and then Hollis and 59.
Yeah.
Surprised you didn't know what Laura's favorite is.
Hal Doyle. We can add it into the group. If there's.
I mean,
yeah.
On the one hand, I'm just like teasing a little bit. On the other hand, it is the Doyle Greenway crossing the big intersections.
So, yeah.
Well, it doesn't have the same impact as like 40th Street. It still seems significant.
I think a friendly amendment to the SCAP proposal would be to add that 100%. So that could be the fourth one.
Be thinking a single intersection.
We're going to try it out first just to see how it functions. We'll probably ask for some feedback at a future meeting. And then from there, we're going to try to get funding to procure more for throughout the city.
Yeah. You folks want to like vote or think about?
I have a question. Do you consider the Bay Trail Avalon?
It was one. Just there's only one leg that had the true bike movement, so we didn't think it would have the impact that another one would.
Yeah. How long is the pilot going to last?
Should be too long, like a month or two, okay. And then for us, and then we'll immediately be up for feedback. So cool. Yeah, we'll have to install. And then the installation timeline is probably by the end of the year.
Do you want to make a strong case for any of the options?
I like 59 Hollis. I think it makes a lot of sense since there are a lot of people cross from the Greenway to get onto Horry Street. And then I believe Adeline and Horton both have the bike markers of where you're supposed to stand to signal. And I don't think, like, there's the big bike block, but it's like, I've always been unclear if that signals to signal at the P9 Hippolis. And I feel like I have got a skip there. I'm definitely guilty of running through it. I don't think I'm getting detected. And it seems to be like one of the busiest intersections in Emeryville and it's very central.
Is the forgive me, but the detection is video, is that right?
Yeah, all these intersections have video detection that we can tie this into as well. That works well.
I think I would. I think for 40th and Horton would be a good one, except that my concern would be that cyclists might be confused by the green light and start thinking that they could go rather than that their weight will be good for. So that would be, so I would actually be inclined to maybe go to the hall for that reason. Seems a little less.
Did you change the color of the light? Or like
it is a blue light, just to be clear. It's not the bicycle one. So no. If there's a green, you should be going at the signal.
Will the blue light be like across the crossing or if you're like right or left?
There's a few places that you can put it, but the size of the sign, in all likelihood, we're probably going to have it on the near side, right near where a bike might be stopped. And depending on the future installs, we might try to do a larger sign for it as well. So my next slide is actually to talk a little bit about that for future signs. But
like coming on this inside will help reduce confusion. This is like, hey, we see you versus like, hey, go ahead.
Yeah.
I think that if what you want is an intersection where it's kind of low stakes, the Horton one is pretty good because you're still going to get the traffic. And like, I think it's, you almost have to try to get hit at that intersection, but you're still going to get bike traffic, so you can get some testing from that. The other intersections are clearly more dangerous, and higher traffic, I think, both of them. So if you want the highest traffic ones, yeah, go to the other two. But if you want one that's a little bit safer to test on, the Horton one is a good idea.
Horton,
Horton 59.
It was
Paul
59.
Wait. Oh, okay. Yeah.
All right, pull up maps if that's helpful.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
I'm good. Wait, so it was 59th, it was 40th and Adeline, and
40th. Wait, all right. That's your point. Yeah, but yeah, it's is like summer tie.
Okay.
An all cyclist
person. Yeah, you want to probably cover?
Sure. Robert, we'll try East Bay again. There's four East Bay cities that have these installed already. Berkeley was the first. There's a hawk, like a pedestrian hybrid beacon at Ashby and Villegas. There's also several in Fremont that protected intersection locations. One in Oakland at Park Excelsior, which is also a bike specific waiting location, and then another one in Danville. So the Fremont and Oakland ones are both bike specific waiting areas. So the detector doesn't have to tell the difference between a bike and a car, which is to help. The Berkeley one was not working well to start, but the light actually helped people know that the detection wasn't working. And so the city was able to tinker with it, and they, you know, eventually, of course, they won't get it working pretty reliably. That one was more complicated, though, because there was a lot of mixing of bike and car traffic. With that in the location, though, there's also an opportunity for a bike rider to filter forward to the stop line. That's something I think about. If the bike rider can't filter forward, then it's not going to be really much use to them. And on like Horton at 40th, for instance, there's very often a lot of car traffic going southbound, and so the bike rider can't always filter forward. So try to think of, for this test, maybe locations that don't get a lot of car traffic on the cross street, but where it does cross a busy street. So 59th and Hollis is a good location, but also that Doyle and Powell one might actually be a good opportunity for that too, where the bike riders are almost always at the front. But it's still a pretty busy crossing.
My two cents on this, it's like you want to have an intersection that's high traffic for cyclists, high risk if it's not, if cyclists feel like this would be an improvement. I think My two top two are 40th and Fulton, as in how many people go through there and get a lot of feedback. The other one would be 59th and Hollis, because it does have that box and easy access to go around, right? At least in the eastbound direction, how I primarily go to every section. Yeah, that's just my two cents. Any other thoughts?
Make a motion.
So we are looking for a motion. I have one more slide to go. Maybe you guys can apply a motion or something like that.
Yeah, but maybe you want to do a motion at the end on this.
So as we're doing some research on this and looking at best signage to use beyond just this, you know, out of the box, Iteris, this is the company that makes these signs. This is their static option. Portland State did a study where they looked at across the country and actually across the world different sign options that are out there. One of the things that came out of that was, so as you do a larger sign, you can do different text as well. So there's different text that was used in some of these signs. And the word detected, as they did intercept surveys with riders after they went through that infection, not everyone knew what detected meant, you know, so it's not maybe super clear what it even meant. So option one is, so we're looking just feedback here for our future signs that as we see how these work with the signal, we might look to do far side installs with bigger signs or something like that. And we want to just get some initial feedback on the language use. Option one is the bicycle detected when illuminated. That's on that terrace sign. The number two is detected when blue light on. It's simple, a little bit more simpler. Action-oriented one where it's bike seen, wait for green, it rhymes, it's catchy. And then option four is signal sees you, green on the way. So if there's any initial thoughts on these, please look. Any feedback?
I like
that. No motions needed here, just feedback, really, on this side.
Option two.
I'd like option three. Like if it was actually that text that would come on when your bike is detected. I don't know if it's clear if it's still like the image of the bike person that comes on. So if you can't like make the text be the thing that flashes, I think I would go with option two.
I'm like thinking, what about other languages? And is there a pictograph that can depict this? So that it is more clear than words that maybe people might not even understand. Even if we're having trouble understanding the English language.
Very tough on this one, yeah. Yeah. Just because it's not a definitely not a standard sign that people see anywhere, you know. But yeah, it's a great thought.
I think the mode of transit agnostic aspect of option two. Is there a scooter?
I do agree that as far as just static text that doesn't light up, two is a much more clear option.
And if it doesn't light up, it's like, oh, my bike has been seen. The sign says it was.
Yeah, I've seen that during the pilot, and it also tracked on people of like want to learn more.
I can see about that. Yeah.
Actually, survey there. Well,
yeah. Okay. If no feedback on that, we are looking for a motion for which intersection for this, if anybody wants to propose.
Would we vote for, would each vote for an intersection, or we all kind of vote for?
It's done different ways, I guess. If there's a preferred from the group, you can just do the motion for that one, and if they don't advise. That's the way to get there.
We could do like straw polls real quick and then have an official motion.
Yeah. Thinking like which ones we want to eliminate. We can narrow it down.
One of these intersections proper.
Who feels really strongly about Adeline and Foyer? Who vote for that?
Anyone mentioned that one?
Great, it's gone. Who feels strongly about Powell and Doyle?
Strongly against that one.
Okay, fine. That leaves two. Much easier to decide. Straw poll, who feels strongly about 40th and
I haven't filled anything.
It's stuck on a year.
Seems like we have a decision then.
Then you would feel strongly against 59th and Hollis.
How much is
it?
Take a vote or just motion?
Yeah, I got both, but yes.
The motion is to recommend the bike detection confirmation light at 59th and Hollis. Okay. Member Banks?
Aye.
Markley?
Aye.
Raymond?
Aye.
Pitch? Peter?
Aye.
Wax?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cohen?
Aye.
Carol?
Aye.
All right.
Consensus.
So look to the intersection by the end of this year, not the fiscal year. By the end of this year, we're hoping to get it up. Okay, thanks.
I have a lot of transit there too, if we're waiting. So let me know when I can put it.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Welcome again. Moving on to information items, starting with information item 6.1, Greenway Safety Update.
To ask them label for ideas. Depending on the views you have on the Greenway safety updates. What this study incorporates is evaluating the feasibility of implementing stop control at the 65th, 66th, and 67th Street and Emeryville Greenway trail crossing. And identifying opportunities for additional safety improvements. So currently, the trail crossing has RRBs with passive pedestrian detection, and what we'll be doing as part of the study is seeing if stop control on the 3 street would be is feasible.
But RRBs, yes, that would be a large.
Thank you. Next slide, please. So before we move on, so actually doing analysis, we want to see the pros and cons of both an IRFB, which was a rapid rectangular flashing beacon, versus a stop sign, which would essentially require vehicles to usually stop at the train crossing before proceeding forward. We have compared the two based on five criteria. First is the effectiveness. Based on FHWA, there is a very high driver yielding rate to pedestrians on marked crosswalks with an RRB. It's up to 98%. Whereas what a stop sign does, it just makes it a clear legal requirement for you to stop before proceeding. The next is the crash reduction factor. It essentially means that once you implement this particular type of traffic control, what it does to reduce the number of collisions that may occur with it. So there is a 47% reduction in pedestrian crashes with the implementation of an RRB versus an up to 25% reduction with the implementation of stop signs. So stop signs give you a lower crash reduction factor compared to an RRB. Best use cases are mid-block crosswalks like the ones we have at the field crossing, and streets where speed limits are less than 40 miles per hour. And best use cases for stop control are multi-way intersections or where the driver expectancy is high. In terms of user experience, an RRB, you can, along with the passive light detection, can allow for continuous trail usage. Pedestrians, bicycles don't necessarily have to stop and they get their out of there as long as the RRB is activated. Versus the stop control, there is limited safety because it really just depends on if the driver stops and allows the pedestrian to proceed or just, come off the stops and does not adhere to the legal requirement of stopping. So there is, and there is that factor, limited safety with stop control. The biggest limitation of an RRFB is that it cannot be applied with any other kind of traffic control. So if you were to install a stop control, you would need to remove the RRFB signs, which are like the flashing signs, and you would again not have any use of the pedestrian passive detection system. Also, like RRFBs can of its effectiveness can diminish if it is you if it's because of overuse, where if it is constantly flashing, there is a possibility that the drivers may not adhere to it as much. Similar things observed with stop sign, where if the driver deems it unnecessary, they may just try to like roll through, and that would create unsafe conditions for both pedestrians and bicyclists. Next up, in this analysis, we conducted a field review of walking through the three crossings and observing and understanding how what kind of limitations we experience while we have the field. At the toll crossing, on the toll crossing, and at the intersect at the crossing itself. And then we also look at existing infrastructure. So currently, all three locations have RRFBs. They have passive pedestrian detection, pedestrian signage, cross traffic ahead signage, raised crosswalks at the three locations, and speed cushions at 65th Street. Some of our observations from the field review, and I'll summarize. There are three slides here, but I summarized them in one. They're quite consistent. At the 65th and 66th Street crossing, when you're at the curb ramp, you are able to see oncoming vehicles. But what we observed was when you're further behind, there were often times that if there were parked vehicles at the trail crossings, like next to the trail crossings, it would often obstruct your view of oncoming vehicles. So if you were further behind, it was harder to see vehicles coming through the trail crossing versus if you were at the ramps itself. One of the other issues that we observed was the current trees. If you are driving on 65th and 66th Street and you're further behind, the current trees block the view of the RRFBs, especially prevalent on 65th Street. So we observed that. So the clearing, maybe recommendations like tree trimming would help with that. And similar thing at 67th Street, we observed that there was the same issue of blocking of the RRFBs coming at the southwest corner, which is at the eastbound approach. And then a parking space, if there was a car park on the westbound approach, it could potentially block visibility coming southbound on the Emeryville Greenway. Next, we conducted stop warrant analysis. Now, essentially what this does is we have two different kinds of stop warrant analysis. We have the always stop, and this is not that. This is your standard tool stop warrant analysis, which is based on three criteria. One is traffic volumes on the street. Next is pedestrian and bicycle counts and collision data. So we collected data 24-hour ADT counts at 65th Street. Amongst the three locations, we chose 65th Street because it is historic. Based on historical counts, it had the highest traffic. So if we evaluated one, then we could apply the same treatment to the remaining two. And so we chose 65th Street for the ADT data collection. Then we used the pedestrian and bicycle data from the eco counter that will be placed on 66th Street and during the crossing. And then for the stop warrant analysis only requires you to evaluate 2 years of data. We chose to review data all the way from May 2019 through June 2025. To see what the history of collisions at these three trail crossings look like. Now, based on analysis we did, in terms of traffic volume, 65th Street had about less than 3,000 vehicles per day, which did not meet criteria, which is supposed to be 6,000. For the criteria to be met, you need to have vehicle volumes over 6,000 vehicles per day. In terms of site distance, we did not see any significant issues with observing pedestrians at the curb ramps. And as a pedestrian who was at the curb ramp, observing oncoming traffic. But if you're further behind on the trail, then it is a little bit tougher to see oncoming traffic. And then in terms of crash history, there were no reported collisions between 2019 and June 2025. Since the stop warrant analysis was not met, we then looked at alternative methods, alternative safety treatments. We used a study, NCHRP report 562, which is improving pedestrian safety and signalized crossings. What this study does is it gives us a methodology to identify what kind of crossing treatments would work best for a location. This also requires data collection, so we use the same data that we got for the stop warrant analysis. And essentially, the data collection for this methodology, for this study, is peak hour turning movement count, peak hour pedestrian counts, and then observe and then field observation of driver compliance to pedestrians. Next, what it does is based on these three data sources, it calculates your pedestrian delay. And once it does that, it will essentially, like the graph on the right will show you, like it will evaluate the crosswalk along with the pedestrian delay to see what crosswalk treatment would be best for this location. So just based on the graph, the green zone that you see where the 65th Street and the trail and the Emeryville trail crossing lies, it shows up as a standard crosswalk with standard safety treatments. Now we do have an RRD here with passive fire detection, which will fall in the enhanced category. What this analysis again shows us is that no additional safety treatments were recommended based on the data that we gathered.
That's a good question.
Yes.
So you explained the green and the yellow. What was the red?
So red is hawk signals. So essentially, if you wanted to have a pedestrian crossing signal or a hawk signal, that would be in the red zone. So that would be like there's just very low compliance to driver compliance to pedestrians, and pedestrians have to wait a really long time to essentially their pedestrian delay increases, and they have to wait too long to be able to find gaps to safely navigate the street. And the red zone would essentially show that, okay, no, you need a proper traffic control here. Like you need a pedestrian control, signalized crossing.
And that's for like low volume of pedestrians, high volume of vehicles, like based on the graph?
It can depend. I'll have to look at that and get back to you, but essentially it evaluates it based on the delay. So you could have low volume of pedestrians and high volume of traffic, and it would essentially tell you based on your pedestrian delay, like, you know, you have to wait this long to cross, and because your driver compliance rate is low, is low, it is unsafe. And so then it will mark you as that. So like any street which would have, if you had over, say like double, the current score is 300, is approximately 250 and 250. But if it was somewhere where like your vehicles were around nine, like what we have here, 1200, 1300, and you had like low pedestrians, then you would see that value triple in there. Even though the stop warrant analysis and the NCHRP report did not show any additional crosswalk treatments, we did think based on field observations, as I mentioned before, that there were some small safety visibility improvements that we can do at three locations. So the first one was free trimming at all three locations for both approaches at 65th and 66th Street. And then for the eastbound approach at 67th Street. Then we recommend reducing one parking space in each direction at each approach at the 65th and 66th Street to improve visibility for pedestrians and bikers that are like further behind in the trail coming towards the crossing. And then, you know, followed by daylighting for that same space. And then at 67th Street, we recommend removing one parking space on the westbound approach and then extending the existing red curb all the way to like the blue handicap curb that is present there. And I also like to add that as a part of the Sustainable Streetscape project, the city is planning on installing speed humps at all three of the trail of the streets, so 65th, 66th, and 67th Street. And I believe, and Ryan and Phil, correct me if I'm wrong, it may be implemented sometime in October, November.
That's correct. And then just one more thing to add here was at the July Transportation and Sustainability Committee, they approved all these daylighting locations. So I don't think we've implemented all of them yet, but in the coming months, those are going to be implemented all the red curbs soon.
The speed bumps are in advance of the race crossing?
That's correct. So there's a similar treatment at 65th today with a small rubberized speed hump. There'll be asphalt speed humps all the way across, but at all crossings.
And as an add-on to the three trail crossing study, we also reviewed bicycle speed limit policies. Several jurisdictions are now adopting speed limits on multi-use shared paths, especially trails with high pedestrian volumes and high pedestrian density. And so we wanted to review for the industry standards and policies that have been adopted, fleet management strategies and policies adopted by peer agencies. So this next section, what we do is talk about what were the results of existing conditions and then the review of various policies that have been adopted by agencies and potentially recommending a bicycle speed limit for the individual greenway. So the first step was to review existing condition and the speed limit policies to bike safe biking. We wanted to do this because speed contributes to about 63% of pedestrian bicycle collisions on shared use paths. And then we wanted to propose a context sensitive speed limit given the high pedestrian volumes that you see at the on the individual greenways. The greenway essentially extends throughout Emeryville from the 9th Street Bike Boulevard to Bay Trail in Oakland. And we did the analysis as a part of the stop warrant analysis, the collision data for the entire Emeryville. So there were no conditions that were observed. When we did field review, which was around the midday peak, it showed high pedestrian activity. We took the data that we got from the Emeryville Eco Counter at 66th Street and compared that for both weekday average and weekend average. This was done from January 1st, 2025, all the way to June 2025. So we used pretty much the entirety of this year that we could and looked at the average weekday pedestrian data and bicycle data and average weekend bicycle data. As you can see from the graphs, pretty much on both weekdays and weekends, we have a high amount of both pedestrians and bicyclists. So pedestrians are significantly almost twice as high as bicycle usage. What were some of the observed use patterns on the greenway? So on weekday, we see, and you know, if it's not clear, the black line is the bicycle activity throughout the day and blue line is pedestrian activity. On the graph on your left shows the weekday trends for pedestrians and bicyclists. Bicyclists tend to be more active during the commute hours, whereas pedestrians tend to be more active during the midday afternoon hours. And by more active, I mean they exceed bicycle activity. So this is more of a comparison between the two. On weekends, the distribution is a bit closer, with bicyclists being more active during the morning and afternoon period, and pedestrians being more active during the late afternoon and evening period. So essentially, to summarize, the existing trends is we see high pedestrian bicycle activity at different times of the day, but which also indicates there is close interaction between them. Next, we looked at policy guidance. So we looked at standard industry standards such as the NBCD, the CVC, NACTO, which is generally provides guidance for various pedestrian bicycle infrastructure improvements. We looked at design guidelines such as Caltrans and ASHTO, as well as City of Emeryville and Alameda County municipal boards, to see whether implementation of bicycle speed limits is feasible, what are the recommendations that are the industry guideline providers, and whether we have adopted any such policies in the past. So CVC allows you to use regulatory speed limits on shared use paths. NACTO typically recommends 10 to 15 miles per hour on shared use paths. Caltrans and ASHTO recommend anything between 12 to 13 miles per hour, depending on grade, with and without e-scooters prohibited or permitted. Then Emeryville and Alameda County have not codified any bicycle speed limits at this time. We also looked at, after looking at the industry standard, we also looked at relevant studies and policies adopted by peer agencies. There was a comprehensive study conducted by Orange County in 2014, which reviewed several shared use paths and speeds adopted by them during that time for a similar effort as we are doing now to implement a 10 mile per hour bicycle limit policy on its shared use paths. From the survey that they did, most trails ranged from 8 to 15 miles per hour, with lower speeds of 8 to 10 miles per hour in high pedestrian areas. Oakland, in its municipal code, has now adopted 15 miles per hour bicycle speed limit with reduced 5 miles per hour near pedestrians and blind zones. What this table shows is additional examples of speed limits that have been applied on multi-use paths. In general, as you can see, 15 miles per hour seems to be the sweet spot for a lot of agencies, but several agencies have added an additional restriction of riding at 5 miles per hour when around pedestrians or near bank zones. There was another study done for pedestrians and bicycle safety for the Golden Gate Bridge. It was done in 2020, where they had reviewed where they collected speed survey data on both the east side and the west side of the bridge. So if you're familiar, the east side of the bridge is a shared use path, and the west side of the bridge is a bike-only path. And based on the study that it did, they observed that the speeds at the east side of the bridge were between 9 to 11 miles per hour, but the speeds on the west side were 17 to 18, which which makes sense. There is more conflict, more interaction between pedestrian and bicyclists. You have lower speeds versus when it is designated bike only path. But what that helps validate is that often in high pedestrian density locations, you may essentially see lower speed limits and lower biking speeds regardless. So what does reviewing the existing trail usage patterns and then the policies that have been adopted, where does it get us? What we recommend is a 12 miles per hour speed limit on the urban greenway to enforce, because of the high pedestrian volume, potential conflicts and potential conflicts and then the ability to, once implemented, the ability to do more outreach, implement signage, and then just promote overall trail etiquette and safer speeds near pedestrians in general. Also, our peer agencies such as Oakland are currently adopting the 50 miles per hour speed limit on its shared use path with 5 miles per hour reduction. So this would be in line with that, but slightly lower because of how heavily used the urban greenway trail by pedestrians. With that, I'll pass it on to that.
So we're looking for some feedback from the BPAC. What we're looking to do with this is take some recommended action to our transportation committee sometime this fall with the speed limit in mind. Back on the 12 mile per hour recommendation from Shruti's team, we're in line with that as well as staff. We agree with that. But one tidbit is that we would like to see it be an advisory speed. So that's a yellow sign, not a white regulatory sign. So it's not enforceable. There's, you know, a lot of stats on, different type of enforcement that happens on bike users, and we don't want to trigger anything in that regard. But we do see a lot of bike-ped conflicts on certain stretches of the greenway where we think advisory signs would be warranted. So ideally, we would have this in some of those areas, so like the northern parts of the greenway, the 67, 66, 65th area. And then maybe some of the other areas to the south near Fusion Park or Landing Park where there's other bike-ped interactions. In the free street areas where it's, like Doyle Street, we likely wouldn't sign those areas. There's other interactions that happen in those areas, but we understand that there's room for speed on some sections of the greenway that we know there's a lot of commuters out there that we don't want to impede on. But we do want to highlight some of the high pedestrian areas as being problematic to go 50 miles per hour plus on. I'm looking at the wrong screen. So we're looking to go sometime this fall back to our transportation committee to implement as we do some speed signs throughout the city. So we're doing another speed limit effort of collecting counts and speed data on regular roadways, and as part of that same effort, we'll be implementing these signs. So timeline is probably early 2026 to install signs in all those towns.
First reading, clarifying question and public comment.
The question about the 12 miles per hour. I was curious why that number was put. I don't know, kind of random because I'm looking at the list of all the other agencies and it's mostly 15 miles per hour. So I was curious why 12 versus 15. I was also curious for the East Bay Regional Park District 1, if the 15 mile per hour is for dirt trail or if it's also for paved. So I was just thinking Iron Horse Trail is the equivalent. And so if that one is 15, I'm wondering.
Yeah, so 12 seemed to be the happy balance in like a more pedestrianized sections of the greenway. So we have a lot of people come with condo entrances. Iron Horse Trail is a lot like maybe same configuration, but not the same you know, people come from all directions on the trail, and then a lot of benches right there in certain spots of it. So we're looking to do this in more of the high pedestrian areas of the Greenway, and I think is one of the highlight needs that we have here. I'm sorry, do you have another part of that question?
No.
Oh, okay, okay, yeah.
Any clarifying questions?
Has the city ever considered like some engineered device on the bikeway, the multi-use path, to alert cyclists to the oncoming intersection?
Not yet.
Yeah,
like a feedback sign for bikes or something like
that. Well, thinking more like almost like a rumble strip or something that bikes would be able to cross.
We have not. No.
Yeah, I have some questions. For the stop sign study and the recommendations, is part of the scope of that work, does it include recommendations around like physical changes, like the city's thankfully already pursuing around speed humps and speed cushions and that type of thing, or is this really the scope is only should we put stop signs in or not?
Scope was whether stop signs were feasible at these three locations, and whether they would operate better as compared to an IFB. And second part of the scope was to see if there were any additional simple treatments that could be applied that would improve safety.
Yeah, I guess this is going to be half comment, half question, because like maybe it was just me that was triggered by the table that you showed early on, just because it's like, if we're talking about compliance, I mean, people are just going to blow through whatever intersection they want, if they're going to blow through whatever intersection. So to me, hearing that is like, as a comparison point, it kind of is moved, right? Like people either see flashing lights and ignore them or see a stop sign and ignore it. And people do both at intersections all around the Bay Area and these intersections that we're talking about specifically. So I guess my question, maybe more to this folks on staff, which is like, what other things are there beyond like speed humps that we would consider, especially in light of like the 65th Street speed limit being reduced recently, which is great, but like it's still a very large street. And until you get to the Greenway, it's sort of a racetrack where like, the 20 mile per hour speed limit is great, but probably sustained speed well. And people do sustain speed well in excess of 20 miles per hour. So I guess how did the city see this? Because it seems like, I think people, like you're answering an important question because I live right at the Greenway, and people are always asked, why are there not stop signs? And I think it's like a helpful context for the city to provide to residents. But at the same time, like people realize that stop signs are probably never going to be the solution. We need like physical implementations that slow cars down, slow vehicles down. I asked the question there.
I think I can make a statement. So yeah. These crossings have always kind of been a hot button issue with the community. It's gone through a few iterations since inception. So it used to be yield signs with some paddles that, you know, yield to pedestrians. We put in the raised crossing. They were perceived not as good enough speed humps, and there's issues with ADA for reasons why they're at the grades they are. So we added speed humps to help slow down traffic there. For just a little history, like, our iterative approach of what we're doing here. All along, though, there hasn't been that history of collisions there. There's a lot of, you know, we can't track close calls, you know, and we hear the reports of them, so not going to ignore that at all. But for us to justify other treatments, we're looking to some of these engineering best practices. And in Shruti's table, you did see the RFBs versus stop signs, the crash reduction that we get out of each of those treatments. There's been studies on that topic, so we're trusting some of that data to keep the RFBs versus stop signs. And you're right, the person that's going to ignore stop signs is probably going to ignore the RFB as well. But what we're seeing is higher compliance and less collisions, you know, and we're trying to prevent collisions. Not necessarily get drivers to do the best thing. We're trying to just, you know, we'd want them to do the best thing, of course, but, you know, we're trying to reduce collisions with our treatments. So we're constantly doing speed limit updates lately. 65th, I think that's one of the ones that's doing again on this next iteration. So For the full stretch 65th from, you know, Shellbound to the city limits, we're going to be looking at that street again with seeing how much further we can reduce the speed limit, and if there's sections that we can get 20 miles an hour all the way across, or maybe even less. So it is a commercial corridor on 65th near Hollis Street, so we're trying to kind of extend our tools that we can to get the speed limits down. And when we're setting the speed limits, we're looking to design the roadway to get that compliance as well, too. So there's, I think in our ATP, we have some 65th Street, you know, separated bikeways in the future planned. So there might be some other updates that happen to the corridor here in the coming years. Oh, okay, sorry. Yeah, just some of the ones up there.
I have a question where Emeryville, the Greenway connects to the Berkeley side. Are there any conversations with Berkeley about adding raised crossings beyond there? Because I just know you go like raised crossing, and then you get to the next one, and it's like there's no, like you have to press the button to, it's not like automatic as you cross.
Yeah, timely question, because they have reached out to us recently as we're doing our speed humps to see if they combine some efforts. So we're in some discussions with Berkeley right now to try to get cohesive treatments throughout, but nothing's finalized yet. So, but once it is, we'll announce it to you.
Good questions. Public comment?
I'm good. So I work for a bike space. I'm also an Emeryville resident. I literally live on the Greenway, so very familiar with the facility. I don't own a car, so I obviously bike a lot, but I actually walk even more on the Greenway. It's kind of like every trip I take kind of starts and ends on the Greenway, so very familiar with it. And I really appreciate, like, I was involved way back in the day with your ATP application for the raised crossings and then some of the tweaks afterwards. And the tweaks that continued to finally get the RRFB flashing beacons working more consistently. And I actually feel like it's working really well right now. And so I appreciate the analysis that's done, and I think that's important. But at this point, I feel like it's kind of like a solution in search of a problem. And I think the crash data now supports that. So I really want to be resistant to like trying to over-regulate or over-sign anything on this corridor. The few things that I do notice that I think could use a little bit of help, and which I think there are opportunity on, some conflicts are when there's new people who have been on the Greenway before. They might not realize it's a mixed bike walk trail and will sometimes, you know, be like all stretch all the way across the trail or not maybe paying as much attention as they should. So something that might help with that is to have the crossings where they cross the streets look different than a standard crosswalk, so it's more obviously a multi-use trail. One example of, and that would help both for people who are walking on the Greenway as well as for the car traffic that crosses at those intersections. So an example you could check out is in Albany at the Albany Greenway crossings. They've got specific markings that incorporate both like the pedestrian elements to make it more like a multi-use trail crossing instead of the standard crosswalk. Those, I think, are going to get restriped anyway because they're pretty worn out at this point. So using a different design might be an opportunity as part of that existing project. In addition, the concrete, the white markings on the concrete don't show up as well because there's not that much contrast. And there's been just ongoing wear issues with the markings on the concrete. So I encourage you to think about that as an opportunity for addressing some of those conflicts. As for the speed limit, most bike riders don't have a speedometer on their bike. So, you know, we're talking like 12 versus 15. I don't even think that's necessarily perceptible to most people on the bike. So if the idea is you want to get across, like, you know, look out and slow down, there's other ways to do that besides speed limits. I think, you know, visually, I think that course of the Greenway is not necessarily a pretty short block. So people are usually slowing and starting and paying attention anyway. I think that really helps, is the shortest of the blocks. Other visual treatments that could even be artistic, like we want to like paint a mural on the Greenway or something like that to make it, you know, more visually interesting, and it can help people, and the, you know, the types of treatments have shown to have effects on speeds as well, just getting people to pay attention.
So I really appreciate the work the city's done. I appreciate the intent of the project, but I really want to resist the urge to try to overregulate or over-control on a facility that's working really well as is. But one more thing, you mentioned the additional speed limit reductions. That's separate, but I'd really like if the city could paint the speed limit on the asphalt addition signage. I think that would really help drive the point of cost, because I've seen some of those 15-mile-an-hour speed limits that aren't really doing the trick quite yet, just the signs.
There are comments?
I actually I agree with pretty much everything Mr. Prince just said. I live on San Pablo. I don't live on the Greenway. But that means that over the course of the last decade, I've seen the effects of RFBBs being installed. And I cross San Pablo every single day, usually with my dog, multiple times a day. And I've seen the effectiveness on a state highway. Drivers stop. It's real effective. I think that a stop sign is something that, yes, some people will just like, you know, kind of maliciously ignore, but a lot of times it just doesn't get your attention if you're distracted, if you like whatever. Where the flashing lights really get people's attention, I've seen a very high rate of compliance. And if it's working so far, I agree we should be changing it. And yeah, as far as the speed limits go, or the speed advisories, I like the idea of the Tri-City area maybe being slightly consistent when it comes to bike stuff. And so maybe adopting as advisory speeds the same thing as Oakland would be good. I feel like we just had this conversation about the 12 miles an hour. And as much as I like get that, again, yeah, they don't have speedometers. But, you know, just giving someone the advice like, hey, slow down when you go past people. The thing about the Greenway is that as much as it is like it's pretty and it's comfortable, lots of places to walk in the city are pretty uncomfortable. The main thing that separates the Greenway literally is how safe it is. And so things we can do to enhance that while not messing it up are all great. I've been thinking about this crossings thing for a while. My view just like, broadly speaking, is that Emeryville, especially as a community that has, you know, such a strong art base already, should be, you know, going forward doing a lot more like art helping with pedestrian wayfinding, and that can include the way you decorate your crosswalks. In my opinion, every Greenway crossing should have a special crossing. It should be painted. It could be painted in a coordinated way. We can also do the same things with the way out to the marina. And when the, you know, when the 65th Street overcrossing comes in, we can, you know, consider something like that. But the Greenway is one of those where, you know, there are definitely sections where it's not obvious where the Greenway continues, mostly right in the middle. It's pretty much entirely. And having the color crosswalks not only helps identify it as a special crossing, it's going to make it feel more safe. It's going to do the one of the easiest things we can possibly do that will enhance the Greenway without messing up any of its current functions, which is at art. And so that's something I think that we should be considering probably as, you know, something to kick over to public art. And that should be part of a long-term improvement that will help safety here, but also just it'll be nicer. I don't know if I had anything else. I think that was it.
I mean, I can go
up with you. Sure.
Yeah, I was also like not sure about the speed limit, or I guess speed caution sign. I was honestly like looking at my Strava trying to see like what my normal speed is, and it's like around like 12 or 13 miles an hour anyways. I think it might be a good idea for like scooters or someone on like an electric bike that they'll see that and be like, okay, maybe I need to slow down. But other than that, not really sure of the use case. Obviously love the ideas of painting some sort of mural or something like that on the raised crossings, but in my experience, going across the crossings seems very safe. Stop signs. Don't think that would that even really like make sense just as a concept. So
I talked to some of my friends who work for other cities. They kind of said that electric bikes are kind of the thing for acceptance. But there's all of these teenagers who are getting these really souped up bikes and are just blowing through places. And I don't know if it's just when I'm on the Greenway, but I personally have not really seen that in our community. It seems like most people are going pretty slow, even if they do have electric bikes. But I can appreciate that maybe the city wants to put in some cautionary signs just in case that ever becomes an issue in the future. But for me, I don't feel like it's a super pressing issue at the moment. And like everyone else has said, I have no idea how fast I ride my own bike. So I think that's why I got stuck on the 12 miles per hour. Like that would just make me stop and think a lot if I thought it.
I have a lot of comments on bike and things. One thing about RR that you can stop them, which I think I don't cover or maybe a group, is like legal liability or something when a crash occurs. There's much more leeway. Let's say, oh, well, they should have yielded, but they didn't yield in. Stop signs are very clear about right of way, and they, you know, for anyone who shows up to the scene or any sort of litigation that happens, very clear who is supposed to yield and whether or not that occurred. So that's one, you know, pro for stop signs. I'm not saying you should change everything just because of that. Or the highlight. Going forwards here, I like that. They're going to add red curves to enhance visibility. Like they're going to trim the trees. I know some of these trees are kind of small, so maybe it'll feel a little taller. You can get those lower branches. With regards to speed limits, like we don't make one speed limit for all roads because roads are different and there's all these different considerations with things that are on the road and road straight if it has good visibility. I don't think one speed limit citywide or for all the roads or all the multi-use paths makes a lot of sense. For example, I was riding on the Bay Trail in Emeryville along the shoreline. There's, you know, two lanes. It's clearly marked where the bikes should be. There's an adjacent little path. And the visibility is impeccable for like hundreds of yards, right? That is going to be a totally different danger profile than twists and turns of the Greenway between 65th and 67th. So I like everyone's ideas about calling out where we have the issues. Hey, if something's happening, we've got a narrow bridge or something, slow down, it is a bell or something. And you can enforce specific areas where you know there's going to be more conflicts. Than others where it's just like very easy to go around. We like the idea of adding some markers of where people should be. I know a lot of it's implied, right? From Western Hemisphere in the US, to walk on the right versus on the left. There's the adjacent little dirt paths that sometimes people walk on, making that more clear, but help organize the people who pay attention to these kinds of things, not everyone. With regards to the rumble strips and other things that we can use to slow down cyclists, there's a nice, unsmooth transition across ocean to get on the Doyle Green where it starts to wind around that really serves to wake people up. You're going really fast. I think we could also think about how we could make things less smooth so that faster users can get jolted. Little bit like malicious design. I certainly hit it way too fast. I had a trailer. Yeah, I slowed down. I tend to ride pretty fast, faster than 15. I wouldn't necessarily pay attention to a speed limit sign. If there was one, it would be my speed. I'm a terror to the local community. By trying to be safe. I haven't hit a pedestrian yet.
Yeah.
I'm honest. Okay. Yeah, it's the same thing with Eden. All right, they have tons of trails. They just went with 15. I think it's probably, if we wanted to pick one speed, probably wanted to pick 15 round, or even reduce it for air, if we know the little twists and turns. Is there any thought of whether people are gonna, or whether they're gonna widen the greenway in 67 ever, or are they just gonna be constrained by property and available space?
Very constrained by the properties, ownership of that right away and all that. So I wouldn't anticipate anything if anyone be clear on that.
Okay. I think that's probably, let's see, here we go. At 5 mile per hour speed limit for cyclists is a no go. And then for e-bikes, like, I struggle with this a lot because, like, there's going to be so many more people riding e-bikes. There already are, it's increasing rapidly. There has to be some sort of, like, e-bikes are a very different form of transportation than a car. They still can go car speeds. I don't know where they best fit. Just do they best fit on multi-use paths because they're defenseless, like other cyclists or pedestrians? They best fit on normal roads because they go fast? I don't really know. I just wish we could think about how they fit in because they're here to stay and they help get people out of cars. So.
I'd like to add that several of the agencies here and also multi-use paths have speed limits assigned for e-bikes, and they can be regulated because they can see it. And then there are several trails where they prohibit use of e-bikes as well.
Then, like, what about the one wheels, like scooters?
Yeah.
You're like, I'm not an e-bike, right? So there has to be some sort of design consideration or even policy consideration that tries to cover all these things that go fast but aren't, you know, 2-ton boxes of perception. Do you have something?
Oh, yeah. I meant to say this earlier, but as much as I think we want to keep the greenway as good an option for, like, all active transportation as possible, if any cyclists who do want to go really fast, we are pretty good about, like, building actual bike lanes. And, you know, in order to keep the greenway the greenway, as long as we do not have the option of making super wide paths where, you know, we can have a specific bike lane that can go their speeds. I think trying to maintain the comfort level for everybody by keeping the speeds a little bit down is good. The speed demons have places to go, and then, you know, that's due to the commitment of this city to build bike lanes. I don't want to kick anybody out, that's for sure, but there are options.
Yeah, hopefully there's ways to create infrastructure that will naturally make people want to do things that are right for that infrastructure.
The city has more or less done that even for the greenway. Like, when I live right at 67th and the greenway, and when I need to get somewhere fast, I take my e-bike, I need to get somewhere fast. I was not planning on talking about the speed limits, but that's as much as I'll say. I still want to push back on this greenway crossings thing because maybe it's just because I had a negative experience a couple weeks ago where 2 times in a row I saw somebody just blowing through the greenway, literally both hands, eyes fully focused on their lap, on their phone. Like, I could see them, and, like, sure, this, like, I was cognizant mostly because I had my, like, 1-year-old on the back of my bike, and I'm thinking, like, sure, like, I can get hit by a bike, whatever, but when I'm with my kid. And I think that's the thing that's maybe hard to articulate about the greenway, although it's very obvious. Like, it's, like, kind of missing in this. But, like, this is where, like, kids ride. This is where parents ride with their kids. This is where, like, people are walking their dogs on maybe slightly too long of a leash. But, like, there are, like, a lot of very vulnerable road users here. Road users, whatever. Greenway users. And I think that's kind of the piece that's missing here is that this is, like, places where kids ride their bikes, like, 30 feet ahead of their parents, and, like, yes, they are in general very well trained and, like, know to stop there, but, like, the stakes are so high at these intersections.
And yeah, I, and which is to say, I very much appreciate that the city is considering this like an iterative process, right? And I just want to make sure that we're being clear, not just at the intersections themselves too, because that'll be great, but you know, the die is cast if they're like blowing through the speed bump, right? Like thinking about the entire corridor of like, how can we actually enforce a 20 mile per hour speed limit on 65th, 66th, 67th, not just by saying, hey, we lowered the speed limit, have to put physical interventions to make kind of critical here.
Please skip you.
I guess I just would say that like having my concern with the RF, these crossings is that there's an ambiguity. It's not perfectly clear to the cyclist and the driver like who gets to go. I do feel like it's working really well. And I go through it pretty often, several times a week. And it always seems to be, but there's that little feeling that, well, a lot of cyclists kind of go through there as if cars are just supposed to stop. And that would, you know, they should, but I'm that with people on phones or whatever. So like maybe making the crossing a slightly different paint pattern, if that was something that could be helpful. I think also just alerting the cyclists who are moving faster that it's time to kind of slow down a little. Just for the, even though, I mean, if I had my way, there would be some kind of hydraulic steel wall that would come up and right around the crossing.
I'm of the sort that believes that RFPs are provide too much of an option. They're aimed at facilitating higher speed traffic. Hopefully to the advantage of those lower speed or pedestrian traffic. I do not have the same comfort Jordan has crossing San Pablo because the cars will whiz past even when I'm halfway across and one car has stopped, they still are roaring past. So they don't even recognize another car has stopped. So it really doesn't signal stop. A stop sign does. So I prefer stop signs. Even though on a highway, yeah, RFPs are reasonable, but like was said, you don't just be walking, looking at your phone as you cross, because you're going to be dead meat. You can't assume that you are protected. So even with a stop sign, but I've found stop signs are far more effective. Yes, they can be run, but it's rare, whereas RFPs, it's not rare. It is constant because if they don't see anybody in the crosswalk, they're going right through that over speed limit. So I don't see them as reasonable. But on the greenway, it just seems, I mean, I don't use the greenways for my pedestrian use, but on the sidewalks where I constantly am displeased with cyclists using, even though it's by city non-regulation is allowed. It's something that they slow down because they realize even when it's signed that cyclists are not supposed to be using the sidewalk, they will, it's something else to, and so I find that speed limits on your greenway, I mean, even you, Jesse, I think even though you're over speed limit, you probably, if you see somebody coming, especially with a trailer, you'll slow down. You'll stop pedaling at least in coast. And so it's, to me, that's just common sense. And so speed limits, they're good for when you go to court. That's about it. And so, but for protecting people from getting hit, I would say, I don't think a speed limit sign is doing anything more than maybe get somebody to say, well, it said I could go this fast, so up yours. And I don't think that we need to give them that power, that authority to go at a certain speed, which a sign would imply. So anyway, that's from a non-cyclist opinion.
Yeah, I guess I also have a lot of thoughts on this as a very regular user of the Greenway. I think I thought about the stop signs on it for a while, but I think our FP with this speed bump is a lot better. I know in Seattle, they've taken out a lot of four-way intersection stop signs and replaced them with nothing. It's all accidents go down because there's uncertainty from both people in the crossings approaching. And I think that's kind of what happens in the Greenway now. Like, I definitely go slower crossing 56th, 67th because I don't know if the car is going to stop, which then makes it safer between those blocks because I'm not just cruising at 20 miles an hour the whole way. And also, cars aren't sure if cyclists are going to stop. And I think giving the speed bump to force them to slow down and think about it, I think it's like very effective, as crossing 65th feels much safer than 66th and 67th right now. I also think that cyclists will not listen to speed limit signs, especially if there's not going to be enforcement. Like, if you bike around Berkeley with any regularity, like, cyclists aren't stopping at stop signs. Why are they like, oh, I should probably go slower? Like, the Greenway does a pretty good job of self-limiting how fast you can go, since the sidewalk is not super smooth. Cycle track, and yeah, there are a lot of people and dogs and a lot going on, but I find myself, as someone who rides relatively fast, normally riding at a very reasonable speed on the Greenway. And I feel safe with myself and others around. But I would recommend keeping the flashing signs adding as big a speed bump as you possibly can. If you want to put not power speed limit signs up, go for it. I just don't think you're going to do anything. Just might be a waste of budget.
Any final member comments? Okay. Thank you for your pen and patience. We'll move on to information. Sidewalk maintenance program. Good evening, everyone.
Awesome. So I see someone here.
Okay. Now I'm going to give you a presentation, the overview about our sidewalk maintenance. Hi. We all use something at the work, school, so shopping, fitness. They're an important part of our streets, parks. But sidewalk maintenance is an aspect of public infrastructure that many cities tend to struggle with. Hence the topic's periodic discussion here at BPAC and a recent referral to BPAC from City Council for a presentation on Emeryville's process. By the numbers, Emeryville has 20 miles, nearly 20 miles of public streets, most of which are flanked on one or both sides by public sidewalks. In total, there are more than 33 miles of public sidewalks in Emeryville. This number includes the Emeryville Greenway. Current city standards require a minimum sidewalk width of 5 feet, the maximum 1.5% crosslope. The minimum thickness for city sidewalks is 4 inches, but this does vary. For example, sidewalks behind commercial or industrial driveway approaches are made thicker to accommodate heavier vehicle traffic. And I'm sure you've noticed that sidewalks throughout Emeryville are not just made of plain concrete. There are colored concrete sidewalks, there are stone concrete paver sidewalks, there are brick sidewalks, there's even wood sidewalks. While these surface materials contribute to the aesthetic of Emeryville and the overall streetscape, they do require more time and cost to maintain. A good example of this is up here at Hollis Street Construction. Two of the intersections have decorative sidewalk treatments, like 53rd Street. A considerable amount of time and effort has gone into developing a layout that complements the original material and design. Now, there's several ways to complete and mitigate sidewalk maintenance activities. Capital improvement projects take care of quality wear. I just mentioned the Hollis Street work, which is occurring as part of our sustainable streetscape project. We've taken on some sidewalk maintenance works with this project and other similar projects. Sidewalk shaving by our on-call contractor Precision Concrete is another way that the city addresses some of its sidewalk maintenance. Where sidewalk edges or joints are uplifted by growing tree roots, oftentimes the tripping hazard can be mitigated by shaving down the raised edge
adjacent sidewalk level, taking the pathway. Safer for this. Our own maintenance staff can also perform minor make-safes, like asphalt ramping or patching at uplifted sidewalks, and paint marking to identify offsets to help mitigate trip hazards while a permanent fix is pursued. City staff also manages the C-click fix items that come in regarding sidewalk hazards and works with various city parties to get a hazard addressed. On the private property side, new private developments going through the planning process often have requirements for public improvements, which can include construction of sidewalks that meet current standards or the repair of existing deficient sidewalks along them. Additionally, any private property owner that is repairing a hazard in the sidewalk along their frontage would need to obtain an encroachment permit from the city before beginning that work. Generally, the responsibility for the maintenance public sidewalks is split between city and private property. The city generally maintains the sidewalk along city-owned properties like City Hall, ECDC, Doyle Hollis Park, all the parks, etc., and has historically taken on the maintenance for the RM zoning districts, which you can see in kind of pale yellow on the edge, the eastern edge of the city there, and in the Triangle neighborhood. Those are lower density residential areas, single family homes, duplexes, that type of development. Private property owners generally maintain the rest, like all of the large apartment or condo complexes, industrial parcels, commercial centers, etc. Now, regardless of who is responsible for the maintenance of the sidewalk, the city will generally have a role in the maintenance of the sidewalks in the public right of way. Through design and planning, the city maintains its sidewalk standards and zoning codes requiring sidewalk facilities are appropriately designed in the public right of way, part of both public and private projects. The city's code enforcement responds to reports of hazards and notifies the responsible party in needed repairs or maintenance. Additionally, city staff reviews and processes requests from the public through C-Click Fix and ultimately deploys the appropriate team to apply the appropriate repair. City inspection staff and consultant staff work with various contractors and stakeholders to verify sidewalk facilities in the public right of way are constructed to the aforementioned standards and codes. This is for both city capital projects and for private development or encroachment permits. Much of the damage to sidewalks in Emeryville is caused by street trees. These trees in the public right-of-way are typically the responsibility of the adjacent property owner. They're also responsible for any damage caused by their street trees. The city's Urban Forestry Ordinance, also known as the UFO, specifically defines who is responsible for the maintenance of which street trees. The adjacent property owner whose parcel is not zoned medium density residential or RM, so those pale yellow zones that were in that zoning map I showed here, is responsible for the maintenance of the street tree, which includes repairing any damage caused by the tree. So the property owner whose parcel is not zoned RM is responsible for the maintenance of that tree on their property frontage. The city is responsible for trees adjacent to properties zoned RM, okay, and any other trees not maintained by those private property owners. The UFO also describes the process for obtaining tree removal permits, planting of replacement trees, and provides a fee structure for tree removal. So, quote, whether it's a phone call, a C-click fix, or the code enforcement officer finds the maintenance issue themselves, an inspection is performed at the hazard location. If the repair is too extensive for a simple sidewalk shaving, then maintenance crews may be called out to install a temporary make-safe asphalt patch. For sidewalks that are the responsibility of the property owner, the code enforcement officer writes a notice of violation, sends it to the property owner, with a timeline to ameliorate the situation by making a repair. Sometimes a repeat notice is required. Ideally, the property owner or their contractor then contacts Public Works to obtain the proper permits to perform repairs, usually an encroachment. During the construction of the encroachment permit work, section staff are ensuring the city standards are being followed. There's no response to the notice of the violation, then an administrative citation can be issued along with the associated penalties. The municipal code spells out the different penalties of these structures related to the items I've talked about so far. For the UFO, the penalties are related to the replacement value fee of the street tree as calculated by the city's arborist using the plant appraisal guide published by the Council of Tree and Landscape Appraisers. The master fee schedule also includes fee structures for encroachment permits and tree removal permits. Administrative penalties are also indicated in the fee schedule and in the municipal code, but need an update for sidewalk-specific penalties. Historically, we have not had to get as far as assessing penalties and get property owners to comply. Excuse me. And get property owners to comply with maintenance requests. We've only within the last couple of years hired a code enforcement officer. However, we think that making the enforcement process and administrative penalties for sidewalk repairs clearer will help us get quicker. Now, moving forward, developing and implementing changes to the penalty structures and sidewalk maintenance violations is something that we hope to begin working on once a new Public Works Management Analyst is hired later this year. By clarifying and streamlining this process, we reaffirm our commitment to maintaining safe and accessible sidewalks. And I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Are most of these street trees demolished?
It's a mix, yeah. So some of them are in an area where the property owner owns it and maintains it, but the city planted it, 30 years ago.
But what are we doing to prevent the trees from causing this bolus for the project? Like, are there root barriers or something?
For the new
project, yeah.
For the new trees we're planting,
like, or just the existing trees that are causing issues.
Yeah, so we are replacing a few of the trees along all of them. We had to take some of them out as part of the improvements. So the ones that we're replacing, there's a requirement to when you plant new trees, you have to include rootable soil volume, and that's to help direct the roots into, like, to keep them from the surface, to keep them from disrupting the potwork improvements, so they can run deeper and go out further, I guess. So we're making sure that wherever we're planting these, we put as much rootable soil volume as we can.
And to add on to that, like, the existing tree planters over there, 4x4 squares, these are now 16x20 areas where we put the soil in. So there's a lot of room for the roots to grow down and deep versus just being constrained right there in that little planter. So there's a lot of misplanted trees in Emeryville's past. Mm-hmm. There's a policy of, hey, there's an empty planter, throw a tree in it, dig a little hole, throw a plant, throw one in.
Also choose vitality and water to well.
Yeah. So there's a city arborist that we have that has recommendations for that. And then all these trees get planted on the Hall Street project have like a 1-year warranty as they go in and a whole we're gonna plant them in the fall, the ideal time of the year. Yeah, and then they have a certain water treatment plan as well for that first year to make sure that they survive.
Yeah, but there's some watering that's like slow and steady versus being superficial. I think they were talking gator bags.
Gator bags get some of that slow drip out, like the hand watering style. Yeah.
Has there been any studies that to look at like the total number of cases where like the the sidewalk is no longer in compliance versus like how long it takes to come back in compliance. Like, are we seeing more damage because the trees have probably gotten large enough? And that's why there's an uptick? Or are we seeing an uptick in like issues because people have stopped complying? Does that make sense?
Let's try to understand the question. I'm sorry.
So, the trees grow because they're old. They've been growing. It has nothing with compliance. I mean, the sidewalks are damaged because of non-compliance and because apparently we never had a program like it's now being told we have, because otherwise we wouldn't have had a picture shown like this that shows it was never done. So apparently we have a new program. So I guess we have to have faith. I'm one that comes from the same place. What? You know, this thing you're telling us about, it doesn't exist. And I wanted to know how much time does it take before the hammer is brought down? We hear this fuzzy, cloudy, you know, concept. But if it's a new program, then I will back off and wait and see how it works. I mean, it's just like Click Fix. There were places along the Marina Parkway, trip hazards, and all that happened was they sprayed it. Oh, look out, you might trip. Well, there was never fixed until finally a council member went down, said fix it, and then it was fixed.
But what do they do to fix something like that?
Yeah, happens.
Is that like they cut down the entire tree?
Effectively, when killing the roots, I mean, yeah. Digging the roots, yeah, you're killing the tree.
So the question is, like, are there more incidents of the sidewalk being destroyed and people not fixing it because people have stopped fixing the sidewalk? Or are there more incidents of the sidewalk being destroyed and not being fixed because there's just the trees got bigger? Like, there's like maybe like 10 years ago, there's only 10 per year and they weren't getting fixed. So there's like 10 incidents of bad sidewalk. Well, like, now it's 100 per year and 50% of them are getting fixed. But like, so even though more are getting fixed, there's just more of them in general. Like, what's the compliance rate? Like, how is that changing over time?
Rather than we don't have any numbers. Yeah, we don't have data on that. Only recently we've had a code enforcement officer to actually have a quantifiable amount of noticing that's going out. A lot of the, you know, prior to the code enforcement officer was our maintenance crews going out there and doing make safes. Us going out to do a shaving, even if it's an area where we're not responsible for. And, you know, in recent years, we're trying to put the onus back on the property owner. So it, in a way, John, it is kind of a new take on the program. The program's always been there, but we're trying to make it a little bit clearer, cleaner when we do notice properties. This is when the fine will hit on this date and all that. So some of the things that Bill said at the end of the presentation, we're working on this fiscal year to implement. So there'd be some municipal code changes to that and some fee table changes for administrative penalties for sidewalks. Right now, a lot of our penalties are tied to tree damage or some other different noticing violation. We want to just clean it clear for sidewalks.
Would it be helpful for letters to be written by residents? You know, what can we do to help? In getting the sidewalks brought to a standard that I think everyone wants. I mean, I'm not saying that Public Works doesn't want the quality of the sidewalks to be there, but what can we do to help make it an issue to be brought to the property owners? Well, we don't want the same thing until somebody raises the flag and says, this is a problem. Fine. I mean, that's something that can be done.
I think it's definitely just notify, you know, so through the different channels, either see Click Fix or direct emails to Public Works. And then we're now, if it's private property owner, we're having code enforcement go out there and start the letter process. And then that starts that chain. And I think the onus is on the property owner at this time. As this goes through and we are doing the administrative penalty, there may be some
talk from council of how it gets implemented? Like, does the city always just wait for the private property owner to fix it, or do we take it on and then lien the property owner? So those that hasn't been decided, that'd be a whole new program to do that, but that will probably be discussed as we go through our council action items down the road.
Has there been those? Sorry.
I was just going to add from like my own personal experience working for cities that have very similar sidewalk policies. A lot of times what happens is that property owners are completely unaware that they're responsible for the sidewalk and they're responsible for the trees until the city suddenly decides that they're not going to put shavings anymore and they're going to like down the road of actually enforcing what's been in their code the entire time. So you guys are going to be really popular when you start enforcing this. And you might be planning on doing this already, but I would say, like, if you're not, like, having a public outreach campaign at the start, just letting people know, like, hey, did you know you're actually responsible? So that they're aware of it. So when that notice comes saying, hey, like, your sidewalk needs to be replaced, it's not completely coming out of nowhere. Because, yeah, I think it's something that people just don't know and feel like, you know, the city's passing the buck onto them when it was in the code the whole time. No one talked about it.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, how long do they have? I mean, has it been talked about at all from when you give them the notice to when they actually have to fix it? And the other part of that is, like, if the request is just to replace the sidewalk, it's probably going to happen again if they don't get rid of the tree. So then what happens with that? Like, are you going to be required to cut down that tree and replace a bunch of other trees? And then who's in charge of that? I don't know. I'm just seeing a lot of, like, other problems. So if you want to answer that.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, we repaired the sidewalk once and, you know, addressed the tree and, you know, we'll probably you'll have the same issue like 5 years later. You'll have to get an arborist out to see if there's something you could do, like root shaving, that maybe might help the repair last longer. Or maybe you can't save the tree, or maybe there are other things you could do, like bridging as well, or you could do because that's like a small concrete bridge over a particular route that's being problematic. These are all more costly solutions if you really want to save the tree, right? But if a tree is that big and it's causing this much of a problem, it's probably too big for where it was planted anyway. So the arborist would probably recommend to remove it anyway and plant a tree that's more appropriate for the size of the parkway strip. But that the arborist would need to decide.
Something in the code where if a tree is taken out, another one has to replace it, or could a property owner just say, like, let's just get rid of the tree. I don't want to fix the sidewalk again. Have
it whole. It's
I can jump in. So planning and public works both take care of these depending on, you know, the project it's attached to. But if it's a street tree, it requires a tree removal permit and approval by the planning commission. And generally it requires assessment, evaluation of the tree that's proposed for removal, and then some kind of equivalent return for the city in terms of like the property loss by that.
And the processes in this urban forest ordinance, so we're all all good.
Sounds like a long process.
It's like, yeah, just walking around and seeing those like big sidewalk, like easy, like seems like an easy solution, but it might not be. And just really annoying walking around and not being able to.
I'm hearing squeaky joint gets the oil, so I'm going to squeak Every meeting, I'm going to be bringing pictures.
Here's a new one.
And here's the same one over again. Yeah. I'd like to hear what's the plan. Yeah. And it works. In the last year, I've gotten good answers. Not on sidewalk repair, but public. Ricky Joe.
Clarifying questions. Public comment.
Hey, Robert again. So by default under state law, the individual property owners are responsible for the sidewalk maintenance. But there are individual jurisdictions that decide to pool resources and have the city take over that responsibility. For instance, just this past November, the city of Albany renewed a ballot measure for a 17-cent per square foot parcel tax. It also has a 50% reduction for low-income residents in order to cover sidewalk repairs. This isn't something that staff can probably advise you on, but you can sort of talk to your elected officials about it. And I personally feel like it's a much more efficient, equitable way of addressing those issues, similar to how we address roadway maintenance. And the city could probably get better quantity of scale costs as a result. And you can build in equity components to make sure that lower, you know, homeowners or property owners aren't disproportionately affected. So that's something I see work in other communities, even though the state's default is different. That doesn't mean that cities can't organize to separate.
Foresee a scenario where there's going to be a lot of very interested property owners where the city is gone and planted a tree. All the property owners, I see you can't remove this tree. Going to destroy the sidewalk, which we then expect you to pay for. And when you ask to remove the tree again, we'll also say no, we won't do the sidewalk again. And I can see that either driving to the south or just be very frustrated. And maybe all the cities are less green city.
I definitely agree with the method of just having tax that covers this and having the city do everything is an overwhelmingly more simple process. This is one of these things that I feel like has come up repeatedly here for years. And the only counter argument that someone jump in if you know, the only counter argument I feel like this is when you have property owners who are in some way have an outsized responsibility for the condition of the sidewalk and the street trees outside of the property, which one can never get. Right. We're talking about overwhelmingly public space that I do think would be better served by just a pure public process as it is for now. As long as we're working with this, definitely having an enforcement person is helpful. Definitely an information campaign before enforcement seems, or at least individual, I'm sure. Knowing the way Emeryville usually works on these things, I'm sure we're not about to go out and start slapping people with fines with no notice, but it would be bad if we did decide to do that. So that's all my comments.
Okay.
I think in Oakland, if you can demonstrate that a street tree has damaged the sidewalk, the city will take care of it, especially given that they are responsible for city trees. And I think people get most frustrated when they have a problem that they're responsible for fixing, but they can't do anything about it, or they feel like their hand is forced in some way, right? So, like, if you wanted to remove a tree, oh, it's going to take forever, and it's going to cost all this money. If you want to maintain the tree yourself, oh, you can't do that because of legal liability of whether or not you're an arborist or not, you know how to do this. So, an option that allows for cost-effective ways. I think you're mentioning previous meetings, you can, Sam Andrew has a way to take care of the issue and they'll just charge you, right? That you don't get this hodgepodge of different fixes and different places and people trying to do one thing and then you walk 20 feet later and then another tree being addressed in a weird way. I think it'll just feel like a lot more complete. There's a more holistic approach to this as opposed to way to address individual trees and individual sidewalks. Any comments? Okay, noting the time. I think we have about 10 minutes left during the meeting minutes. 10 minutes of scheduled things. You want to extend the meeting by 15 minutes? Is there a motion to do that?
I so move.
For what?
I so move.
Okay.
Second.
For Bakes? We have information item 6.3, planning updates.
You actually have updates this time. I mean, not very exciting ones, but. Okay, so in terms of Sutter, basically no motion on the project. We don't have a detailed project description. We don't have plans. We don't have anything that isn't already published on their website about what the project is. I will just note for clarity on SB 830, which is currently in legislation right now, that bill as written does not impact the CEQA analysis process. It will not streamline the impact analysis under the EIR, and specifically it relates to judicial review in the case that there are lawsuits afterwards. So I just want to note, EIR analysis is not affected by it. Mira Desai, who is the project planner in the city, who's responsible for the Sutter project moving forward, has offered to provide what update she can at next month's BPAC. Again, there's not too much detail, but if you have more specific questions about process and what this might look like, she can answer those for you. It's probably hard to say if she'll be able to answer any actual details about the project itself at this point. Planet Fitness, which was a project proposed and approved at the former CVS site on San Pablo and 45th, was issued their building permit last week. So hopefully we should see them breaking ground and doing their tenant improvements for that project. I mean, it was formerly a convenience store and they're establishing a full gym, so they need to do interior tenant improvements. They're not doing too much to the exterior other than a repaint. They're going to be providing public art of some kind. We don't know who the artist is or the nature of that yet. And signage. So that, yes.
Are they planning, I know their branding is very purple. Are they planning on repainting the whole thing?
The building will not be purple. Oh, their okay. Signs will be purple.
Okay.
But the building itself will not be purple.
But are they going to be overpainting all of the temporary art that we had put up there? Like,
as far as I'm aware, yes. So they did submit for some design review, months ago, which just showed a pretty general, like, repainting of the building. The art that is currently on the building was basically a stopgap measure to address graffiti and tagging that was happening. I don't know kind of their position or approach moving forward, but they did trigger, again, our public art requirement. So they're required to provide public art of a certain value, which at the moment they've communicated maybe a mural. So once we know the artist and design, myself and then Amber Evans, who runs our art program, will review that and make sure it looks good, meets our standards. This is an interdepartmental thing, but as you know, the website was updated a month ago. If you are having any issues navigating it, if you go to our main page, everyville.org, scroll down to the bottom, there's a survey. Planning Division is definitely still making updates and tweaks as we go. So if you have any comments or issues finding things, please let us know. And then I just also wanted to highlight the next month is the first Everyville Art and Culture Month through the Rotten City Cultural District. There will be a number of events weekly, including the celebration of the arts opening, art tours, historical society walking tours, and immersive exhibits. So if you go to their website, check them out, you can sign up for some of those events. A lot of them are free. That's it for me.
Any questions?
Quick question. I looked it up in one of the exits for that. What is the actual bounds of the Sutter Health? Like what streets are bound by?
I
can speak to that. So it's Stamford Avenue to the north. They're doing the corner at Stamford and Hollis Street. And then they're doing the corner, the 53rd and Fordham Street. So between those two parcels is their campus areas that they're looking at.
Basically, it's where Chiron used to be?
Yeah.
It's not going south of 53rd?
Not south of 53rd. And they're also looking to take over the southeast corner, I believe, of 53rd Hollis as well, that existing building, keeping that building.
Any questions? Public comments? Member comments?
It's been long enough now that I'm not sure who was that's with us now was in the room at the time, but it was pretty obvious since we're talking about Sutter that there was going to be some pretty major traffic impacts even before you knew that was going to be a Sutter project, when we thought it was going to be a million square feet of lab space. And we're now approaching the time where it's important to start thinking about what safety upgrades we need there. We obviously, as Planner Chung mentioned, don't have any details. We just know there's going to be a lot going on there, and that's going to drive a lot of traffic. So I've been studying it. I hope you all take an opportunity to study it, because it will be fun to give our recommendations as this project goes forward.
Thank you for the updates. The commission items before public works update. Okay. So yes, public works update. So Hollis Street construction, it's 1.1. That was a different universe where we thought it would be that right now. Yeah, so it's continuing. They out here doing work today. They were relocating a conduit for very exciting stuff. Work continues on the green infrastructure along the corridor. That's great. They're also working at Powell Hollis, which is very exciting. They're working on the plaza there. Should have that the concrete work done there by the end of this month, which is nice, except for the green infrastructure that I think they're going to do that after. But the plaza should be, the rest of the paving should be. And I don't know if you guys have noticed, but the wind spire was taken down last week. That was kind of a interesting thing. Actually, we called it the VA speaker.
And then get a new piece of public art will be placed there later this year as well, for in replace of the AP.
But also scrambled eggs.
Possibly.
I get violent in the sun to do it right on. They're trying to coordinate the construction schedule with the news. So yeah, hopefully that happens in the park. Also wanted to mention. Also wanted to mention that we are working on our daylighting project, and we're going to have our works maintenance staff paint all of the AB 413 daylighting zones throughout the city by the station committee. We're putting the maps together and putting them out there and start painting. Actually, we're in compliance with the law now. You don't have to paint the curbs. It's still the part there. We just want to, make sure people know not to park.
Some people still don't know that it's a lot. And this island, I would share this. Not exactly nothing, but on September 20th, there's a coastal cleanup from 9 to 12. Yeah. It's a cute little flyer she put together. And yeah. I heard her talking to Matt on the phone earlier today, and I heard mention of bagels and pastries and all that good stuff. So.
I heard treasure.
I see treasure on the flyer.
You can see it right there.
Lots of plastic. So post a plan up September 20th. And
quick tangent related to buried treasure on shorelines. Has there also been radioactive stuff detected at the Amberville Marina, similar to the Brooklyn Marina? Does anyone know about that?
That's to our knowledge, we wouldn't say it on the slide.
Yeah.
But the Brooklyn one is more that they're testing.
Right.
As a good term. Well, it's that it's above.
Like, this is real.
It's real. The shot is barbed. They're like disallowing all digging.
Yeah.
It's an interesting part of the title.
It'll be a coker. Mr. Perry Fender, I thought about the history of the region. Anyway, sorry. Okay. Coastal cleanup.
So bring your Geiger counters.
Yeah.
yeah. So tell us about it.
Question about things also related to planning. I just forgot to ask. The Bay Wheel stations, when I heard something, there was movement on planning there too, where like there were sites were approved or something. Is that right? When we expect installation?
Yeah, the three most recent ones were approved by Transportation Committee, and the curves have been painted. And I think we're waiting on
permit. I think is about to be done or something. But there's a little bit of coordination that had to happen, but should be hopefully cleared and installed pretty quickly once they're done. So
yeah, we're pretty close. I believe, yeah, as far as I'm aware, still in the encroachment permit process. Each of the stations is like a one-day installation. So once they're good to go and they've established a date, they can just go in, do it in one day and get out.
Probably this year.
I mean, I think so. Yeah, I really hope so. But it's one of those things that I'm like, man, hesitant to say out loud.
Now, all the questions since I ask every time. We already covered the speed bumps at the Greenway. For Doyle, I know that was kind of contingent on Hollis wrapping up, right? Or at least the paving of Hollis. Happening? Do you think that'll happen by the end of the year? Or
the
Doyle between 59 and 51st?
Yeah, we are hoping that that'll be constructed when the Hollis paving happens, so it'll all be kind of done at the same time.
Okay, we've got a table for Hollis paving.
Yeah, now they're saying probably by the end of next month they'll get the start. The start by the end of next month. Yeah. It's getting kind of in there.
So also by the end of the year for Doyle, probably.
Yeah. That's the reads. Just isn't that convenient?
This paving, so they can pave it around the rain a little bit. But, yeah.
Different questions?
Comment?
Well, there was one Bay Wheel station added across the border at 65th in San Pablo, so there was that one in the meantime.
Okay, thank you for the update. Any future agenda items? Announcements, remember comments?
A few announcements. One from Rob, so I'll read your email. So heads up to everyone about some looming input deadlines for Oakland and Berkeley's bikeway plans. Each of their bikeway plans touch our Emerald border, so it's very important to get our input as well on these items. So Rob and I encourage you to check them out, share with VPAC. So one is the Oakland Slow Streets Network. Their draft is available online, and the comments are due September 11th, so very soon. So have some free time tonight or tomorrow. Be awesome. The other one is the Berkeley bike plan update, and comments are due on September 26th of this year. So we'll have Bill set some direct links to these plans to the whole feedback. Oh, and then, second announcement is PG&E is doing some emergency work tonight. So if you are in the Shellmount Loop area from 10 p.m. to 3 a.m., all power is going to be out in that area tonight. So all the signals will also be out tonight. So I would avoid that area if you are out that late tonight. You do you.
Great. There are no more announcements or comments. We can adjourn 7:35.